L-E-T-E-N-P-C.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Okay. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, continuing with the author Scott Eyman. The book is Charlie Chaplin versus America, When Art, Sex, and Politics Collided. The Second War is over. The catastrophe has happened. There are tens of millions of dead. There are war crimes tribunals in Europe and then war crimes tribunals in Japan. And Hollywood, like everywhere else in America, institutions, trying to go back to work with the returning soldiers. Charlie Chaplin's going back to work. He's world famous, and he wants to make movies. He's got his own studio, and he has plenty of money, lots of money, although he's still haunted by the poverty of his childhood. He can no longer be the tramp. He needs to deal with speaking pictures, and in this instance, he comes across a plot, a story idea, given to him or suggested to him by Orson Welles. It will eventually be called Monsieur Verdoux, a French name, but it was in Orson Welles' mind as a serial killer, a bluebeard called Lady Killer. Scott, this is a wonderful story to introduce Orson Welles. Orson Welles' idea, what was it based on, and how did they see it as comedy? Good evening to you.
Thanks, John. Welles came to Chaplin a few months after Citizen Kane opened with this idea. It was an idea that Welles wanted to direct and use Chaplin as the star to play a character based on Landru, who is a famous French serial killer who murdered a succession of his wives. Well known in France, not very well known here at all. Chaplin told Welles that he appreciated the offer, but he didn't work for anybody else except himself. But he liked the idea and he wanted to buy it from Welles. So he bought the idea for $5,000 from Welles. The interesting thing is Welles and Chaplin never really liked each other, which, and I suspect the reason was because there wasn't enough room on Everest for two egos that size. They both had outsized egos and both of were used to being autonomous. And neither one of them was used to collaborating meaningfully with anybody else. An Orson Welles movie is an Orson Welles movie. You can tell it's an Orson Welles movie in 30 seconds. The same thing with Chaplin. They had to work by them. They had to work alone. They had to work alone. But Chaplin paid Welles $5,000 for the idea. And he waited. This was before the Joan Barry incident happened. After the Joan Barry incident happened, he had married Una O'Neill, the daughter of Eugene O'Neill. And they began their family. They eventually had eight children together and stayed together for the rest of Chaplin's life. And he began shooting Monsieur Verdoux in 1946. It came out in 1947 and promptly presented him with the only professional flop he had as a filmmaker, really, until his very last film in 1967. It was, the critics hated it, by and large. The public ignored it. By and large, it didn't do business anywhere in America. It did okay in Europe. It did much better in Europe, but it would. It's a cold-blooded movie about a serial killer, which is not what people after World War II in America wanted to watch. It was the wrong movie for the wrong audience at the wrong time, and it left Chaplin with a considerable degree of bruised feelings. Because he felt it was a good picture. He felt he'd offered his audience something different than what they expected, perhaps too different in retrospect, he would think. And he thought maybe he'd made a mistake in his treatment, that you could convince people with laughter more than you can with drama. And he thought maybe he'd erred on the side of not having enough humor in the picture. But it was on him. He always took responsibilities, because if the audience doesn't respond, it's on me, he would say. And a reporter asked him once, well, you don't say that about books. He said, books are aimed at the intellect. Movies are aimed at the emotions. And if I fail to reach an audience's emotion, that's on me. So in time, he basically took responsibility for Monsieur Rideau himself.
Thanks
but
to
at,
your
at the time, in 1947, it was a deep, deep wound.
Thanks to your book, I saw Monsieur Rideau for the first time. You guided me to it. And I follow Aldous Huxley's comment, it's a mess. But it's a mess that happened simultaneously, and I ask you for the linkage, simultaneously with the House Un-American Activities Committee lining up to call or to speak to or to identify Charlie Chaplin as a risk to America. Is that because the movie was a flop? And he was, for the first time ever, no longer a success, no longer a big hero? Or was it going to happen anyway? They were going after all the major stars.
They were going after the Un-American Activities Committee initially focused on communists and former communists. It was easy for them because the FBI had by this time informers within the Communist Party in America, and they had the membership roster. So they could look at the membership roster for Los Angeles and see who had been a member and who was a former member, and those were the people that constituted the Hollywood 10. Every member of the Hollywood 10 either was currently a member of the party or had been a member of the party and quit. So they were all basically guilty as charged, so they had no place to hide. After the Hollywood 10 hearing, the net began to broaden to include, I guess, what you could call apostates, to include nonconformists. To include people who never had been members of the Communist Party. And that definitely included Chaplin, who had been investigated. By 1948-49, Chaplin's house had been surveilled. His mail had been opened. His taxes had been audited, both corporate and personal. His employees at the studio, at the Chaplin studio, had been interviewed. And the FBI knew definitively that he was not a member of the party, had never been a member of the party, had never donated money to the party, and they still wanted his hide because he'd made Monsieur Verdu. He had a difficult sex life, shall we say, flamboyant sex life, shall we say, which outraged J. Edgar Hoover no end, and a lot of other people who counted themselves in the same circle as J. Edgar Hoover. And they wanted Chaplin. They wanted him out. And they couldn't get him on the conventional way of getting him out, which was to find that he'd been a communist, because Chaplin had not been a communist and was not, in fact, a communist. I don't even think he was a fellow traveler.
Did he know they were after him? Did he know they'd been tracking his bank accounts, tapping his phones, sure, watching his house?
I don't know how he couldn't have. I don't know how he couldn't have known. He might not have known that his phone was tapped. That's possible that he didn't know that. But he certainly knew he was being surveilled.
Did HUAC know that FBI had been harassing him for, what is it now, 20 years?
Sure they did. Sure they did. They had access to the files. They had access to the FBI files. So they had intended to call him in 1947 as part of the initial House Un-American Activities Committee. But that was canceled, finally. They never did call him because they knew he hadn't been a member of the party, and that would gum up their narrative that they were constructing at that point, where everybody they called had been a member of the party or was currently a member of the party. By bringing Chaplin in, who was not a communist and never had been a communist, that would spoil the narrative, so they decided not to call him. But the propaganda campaign against Chaplin continued apace. As he was a citizen, he'd never been a citizen. This was used to hammer him over and over again. He had retained his British citizenship, his relationships with women, his dangerous anti-fascism in making the great dictator, his insufficient patriotism about American industry in modern times. All these inferential things were thrown into a kind of political gumbo that was used to assault him for years at a time, almost on a weekly and certainly a monthly basis. Somebody was always writing a negative Chaplin piece in the popular press from basically 1942 through 1953, 1954.
This is so a wonderful time to ask about
it was cumulative character assassination.
About Hedda Hopper. What was her opinion of Charlie Chaplin that she stayed on him like a stalker for decades? Why?
She thought he was a great actor. She thought he was politically dangerous. And there was a personal issue as well. Hedda Hopper had been married to a man named DeWolf Hopper. DeWolf Hopper was famous for his recitation of Casey at the Bat in vaudeville. That was all he was known for. He was elderly. He was about 30 years older than Hedda Hopper. He had been married four or five times previously. The marriage broke up. He basically dumped her without any support, leaving her with her son, William Hopper, who became Paul Drake on the Perry Mason TV show. So she projected her loathing of her ex-husband onto Chaplin because she took him to be the same kind of louche character that her ex-husband, DeWolf Hopper, had been. So he checked off all of Hedda Hopper's boxes, you might say, emotional boxes.
While this is going on, Charlie's going to make a movie that is a recapitulation of his life, Limelight, when we come back. Scott Eyman is the author, Charlie Chaplin versus America, When Art, Sex, and Politics Collided. I'm John Batchelor.
Chances are, you've been to the doctor recently, and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your Social Security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.